Welcome to Hearing Voices. I'm Larry Massett. Soon after the World Trade Center fell in autumn 2001, it became clear the United States was going to invade Afghanistan. Producer Scott Carrier thought he needed to go over there too. Why? To see for himself, which is what writers do. Who are these fanatics, these fundamentalists, the Taliban and the like, and what do they want? In his new book, Prisoner of Zion, Carrier talks about his adventures, but also about something larger. Having grown up among Mormons in Salt Lake City, he suspects it will never work to deal with true believers by attacking them head on. The faithful thrive on persecution. Somehow, he thinks, we need to find a way inside ourselves to rise above fear and anger. Tall order, right? Scott's going to read us excerpts now from Prisoner of Zion. We will be focusing on just one of the stories in the book, the story of Najibullah, a young Afghan who became Scott's guide and later his student. We begin as Scott is crossing into Afghanistan for the first time.
Late November 2001. I step on a tugboat with four other journalists, and we start across the river that separates Uzbekistan from northern Afghanistan. The current is fast and deep. For the first time in weeks, I relax. I breathe deeply. I feel the line being crossed, and yes, I want to go. I've been afraid I wouldn't get in, afraid I'd have to stay home and watch the war on television and listen to everybody say, God is on our side. Watching the news scares me. Crossing the river feels good. If we're going to kill and destroy, I want to see the killing and destruction, because my guess is God won't have anything to do with it. My guess is God doesn't care one way or the other. On the shore of Afghanistan, a man in a worn-out sport coat and scarf stamps my passport, no problem. And I cram into an already full Toyota microbus going into the town of Mazar-e-Sharif, 60 miles to the south. We drive on a ribbon of asphalt across a desert of sand dunes and drifted snow, empty except for some nomads with a Bactrian double-hump camel and a dog that looks like a cross between a mastiff and Newfoundland. As we approach the city, the road is lined with metal shipping containers, all left behind by the Soviets. Now people are living inside them, a rusted steel cube shanty town on top of a garbage heap, plastic bags blowing in the wind as we drive by. The women are covered in burqas, the men are wearing long shirts and pajama pants held up by a string around the waist. They wrap blankets around their shoulders, but they have no socks, and their shoes are plastic slippers. Mazar-e-Sharif sits on the flatlands before the northern slope of the Hindu Kush. The streets are mud, and the buildings are brick and concrete cubes, side by side, flat roof tops with clusters of rebar sticking up like wild grass. There are men pulling carts with wooden wheels. Other carts are pulled by horses and donkeys, carrying wood and bricks. There are shops with skinned goats hanging upside down out front, shops where chairs and tables are made, shops with material for clothing and drapes. The hotel, the one hotel that's open, is just across the street from a blue-tiled mosque. My room is tiny and cold. Four walls, a window, and a thin cotton mattress on top of wire springs that sag and creak almost to the floor when I lie down on them. The electricity is off. The bathroom is down the hall, but I'm told there's no water now. There's a restaurant, but it's not open. I stare at a bare light bulb hanging from the ceiling as the noonday call to prayer breaks through a loudspeaker at the mosque. It's not a recording. It's an actual guy over there in the minaret, and he's wailing a song that's more than 1,000 years old, and it's beautiful, soul-wrenching, and frightening. I decide to go for a walk, a I leave the hotel, cross the street to the mosque, the blue-tiled dome, and stop to look at it. Four or five young men also stop walking, like they had just been pretending to be going somewhere. They stand right in front of me. Then quickly there are 10, then 30, all boys and men, crowding close together, 100 eyes looking at me like they can't believe what they're seeing. "Where are you from?" a teenage boy asks. "America," I say, wondering if this is a good thing, because we'd just bombed their country. But it's the word they want to hear. They want to say it. "America, America, America." "California," I say, wanting to hear it echo. "Mississippi." Three or four of them are trying to speak English. "Hello, how are you? Thank you very much. Okay, good luck, goodbye." I ask the teenager, "What do you think about America bombing your country? Was it a good thing or a bad thing?" "It was a good thing. When the Taliban here, there was no working, nothing working. Now America comes here. Is it correct? America comes here?" "You mean, will American soldiers come here?" I say. "I don't know. Maybe." He translates this for the crowd, and they start shouting questions, too many to translate. Sort of frustrated, he says, "We want money to make work. We want now the schools." "I think there might be some money," I say, "but I don't know. We might start bombing some other country and forget about Afghanistan." This makes the yelling get louder. They're not yelling at me, but more just yelling for the sake of yelling, filling the space with their voices. I look down, and there's a guy in a small cart like a wheelchair. One of his legs is missing, and the other is very short, like a baby's. He's saying he needs a new cart, a real wheelchair with bicycle tires like they make in America, and some artificial limbs like they make in America, and he wants to know if I can get him some. The crowd keeps pressing in, getting tighter and tighter, so I pull out my camera and start taking pictures. They become quiet and still, not afraid or shy of the lens, but also not quite sure of its power. I hold it at arm's length, down low, and they stare straight at it, and I take their pictures. While I'm doing this, I hear a voice, a soft, calm voice next to my ear say, "Excuse me, are you a journalist?" I turn and see a young man with a shaved head. "Sort of," I say. He's wearing a Planet Hollywood t-shirt over a brown turtleneck, checked polyester pants two or three sizes too big and cinched by a belt, kind of a punk look, and I have a feeling he might actually be a girl. He has beautiful eyes with long lashes and a soft voice. "What are you doing?" he asks. "Just taking pictures," I say. "How old are you?" 19, he says. "Do you need a translator? I've been studying English in school, but there is no school now. The Taliban sent our teachers back to Turkey. I would like very much to work for you. I will help you in any way that I can, and I will not leave your side. As long as you are here, I will be with you." "What's your name?" I ask. "Najibullah," he says. "Najibullah, why did you shave your head?" "When the Taliban leave 2 weeks ago," he says, "many men shaved their beard, but I do not have beard. So I shaved my hair." "Good one," I say, "but I'm sorry. I don't have very much money, and I can't afford to pay a translator every day." "For me, money is not important," he says. "If you have money, you can pay me. If you don't have money, you don't pay me. When you're finished, you can decide." I know this is a deal that could go sour very quickly, but I do need a translator, and to a certain degree, I believe him. He's trying to learn to look and act like a Westerner, and probably the best way for him to do it would be to hang out with me. "Come," he says, "let's go to the hotel." Only 2 weeks ago, Najibullah tells me, the Taliban controlled Mazar-e Sharif. But when the Northern Alliance began to surround the city, they fled in pickups and trucks. About 450 Taliban surrendered just outside the city. They were taken to a fortress where they were held overnight. In the morning, they started an uprising, killing an American CIA agent who'd come to interrogate them. They took control of the fortress. A three-day-long battle ensued with heavy bombing from the air, artillery from the ground, and a lot of shooting. But it's over now. About 400 Taliban were killed, 68 survived. Can we go there, I asked Najibullah. Can we go to the fortress? He comes back in a half an hour with a 10-year-old Corolla and an elderly driver. I loan Najibullah my sunglasses and hat, and he thinks he looks like a U.S. Special Forces soldier. This makes him very happy. He's driving the car, the old chauffeur relaxing in the passenger seat, willing to let the teenager go 90 miles an hour across the desert, pounding the steering wheel to the beat of some Afghan disco music. He drives too fast, and he slows down and speeds up too quickly. There are many potholes in the asphalt, some that can be avoided, but others that quickly go from bad to worse, and Najibullah slams on the brakes as the car crashes to a series of large holes. This happens again and again, even though I keep telling him to slow down.
You're listening to Scott Carrier's Prisoner of Zion on Hearing Voices.
I'm in the basement at Kala Ijangi, pointing my headlamp at the bodies of Taliban soldiers lying half buried in rust-colored mud. This is the medieval fortress where the prisoners revolted. The Northern Alliance dropped rockets and hand grenades into the basement, one after another, all afternoon, so many it became monotonous and boring. The next day they poured gasoline and diesel fuel in the basement through a ventilation duct, and then they lit it on fire. Still, the survivors would not surrender, so they flooded the basement with water, cold water from a deep well. They poured in so much water, the dead bodies started floating, and men who were too injured to stand up drowned. These Taliban have been dead for days, floating in water, but now the water has gone down and the mud floor is swallowing the bodies, swallowing my feet up to my shins, making a loud sucking sound when I walk. The smell burns the skin on the inside of my nose. They'll never get the bodies out of here. They'd have to dig them up and then rebury them. I watch a man carry wet coats up the stairs from the basement. He carries them on his shoulder, carefully avoiding an unexploded mortar sticking out of the wall. He'll search the pockets and then sell the coats to poor people who are so cold they don't mind wearing something that smells of death. Now I'm sitting outside the building, using a stick to pick the mud off my boots. It's not working because the mud is like cement. There are 3 inches of snow on the ground, and it's snowing, lightly. There are bricks lying everywhere from exploded walls, and at first I don't notice that the brick next to me is not a brick at all, but a human foot broken off at the shin. It's charred and swollen, with a tuft of snow on the heel. I look at the foot and go back to cleaning my boots. Najibullah is in the taxicab, honking the horn. He wants to get out of here. The land looks like it's been lying fallow for years. In the distance, there are small caravans of camels and herds of goats, and running along next to the road is a natural gas pipeline, rusted, resting on the ground or on small dirt mounds spaced 100 yards apart. Is that a real pipeline? I asked Najibullah. Yes, it's real. It's the only one in Afghanistan, built by the Russians. The gas goes to Mazar-i-Sharif. And it actually works? I asked. Yes, for electricity in Mazar. We have 1 5-megawatt station. My father, he helped in building this as a geology engineer. Up ahead, there's a teenage boy with a Kalashnikov on the side of the road. And Najibullah pulls over and stops. It's not a checkpoint. The boy just wants a ride, and we have to stop because he has a gun. This is a common form of transportation for the soldiers, but when the kid comes up to the car, the old chauffeur starts yelling at him in Farsi, "What are you doing? You shouldn't be out here on the road stopping cars. This man is an American, and you should be careful not to upset him, or the bombs will find you in your house." The kid falls back like he's been punched hard. "He really believed that," I say. "Yes, they all believe it," Najibullah says, "and it's true." Yeah, but I can't make it happen. But he doesn't know this, says Najibullah. The old man looks at me and smiles. There are bomb craters in the road, 12 feet wide and 6 feet deep, and the burned-out shells of Toyota pickup trucks off to the side. The old man has to slow down and weave between wreckage, and he starts complaining. He says this was a good road before the Americans bombed it. He wants to know if somebody's going to come and fill in the holes. Yes, for sure, I say. We have special machines for doing this. They're called bulldozers, very big and strong, and we have so many, we don't know what to do with them. I make a note in my notebook, a reminder to call the road department when I get home. Is it okay if I smoke? I ask. I'm hungry, and because it's Ramadan, there's very little chance we'll be stopping to eat. Yes, go ahead, the driver says. But isn't smoking against the rules of Ramadan? Yes, he says, everything's against the rules of Ramadan. It's forbidden to even smell a flower or to look at a beautiful young girl. But it's okay if I break the rules? For you, he says, it's not breaking the rules. You're a Christian and you have your own book. And so for you, it's not forbidden. Am I right? You're right, I say. In fact, Jesus smoked hashish. No, I think this is not true, he says. Well, maybe not, I say. But Muhammad smoked hashish, didn't he? I'm making all this up. I know I'm bordering on rudeness, but I grew up with religious fanatics, among the Mormons, and sometimes I can't help myself. What's the deal with women, I say. I haven't seen one woman since I've been here who wasn't under a burqa. Don't you wish you could look at women, you know, just to look at them? The old man is stunned. Najibullah tries to smooth things over by telling me that perhaps with the Taliban gone, the women will someday take off their burqas. But right now, it's not such a good idea because these women might be beaten by their husbands or fathers. So have you ever gone on a date? I ask him. What's a date? He asks. Like when you go somewhere with a girl and maybe hold her hand or kiss her. No, I've never done this. I've never even spoken with a girl other than my sisters, he says. If I speak with a girl in this way, then our fathers would beat us with a stick. What if you actually had sex with a girl? I ask. Then we'd both be beaten many more times and forced to marry each other. What if when you're married, or not you, but somebody else is married and his wife has sex with another man, what would happen? Then she'd be killed with a Kalashnikov, he says. Who'd kill her? Her father or her brother? I don't believe that, I say. It's true, he says. Believe me. You would do this? You'd kill your own sister? Yes, he says, I'd have to, for my family. With a Kalashnikov, I ask. Or by putting the stones on top of her, the old man adds. They look at me with stern faces, and I give up. Yes, of course, I say. Luckily, you guys have plenty of stones around here. I make another note, a prescription for Afghanistan. Bulldozers and LSD. The power is off in the hotel, as well as the entire city of Mazar, but I have a box of wooden matches made in Latvia. I can't remember how I got them. They're fine wooden matches, Avion, with a picture of an old airplane. The box is also made of wood and sturdy. It seems very exotic and very much out of place. I've been waiting for an hour for dinner to be brought to my room. I asked the 20-year-old concierge if there was a way I could order something to eat. He speaks English pretty well, though sometimes with an attitude, but we get along because I tip him 10,000 Afghani sum, about 30 cents, whenever he does something for me. Yes, he snaps. What do you want? Do you have dinner? I ask. Dinner? He says, as if he's never heard the word. Yes, dinner, I say, like kebab. Do you have kebab? Kebab? No. How about rice? Yes, rice. And bread? Rice and bread. And tea. Okay. Do you have anything else? What? Is there anything else they can make in the kitchen besides rice and bread and tea? I ask. No, he says. Okay then, I say. Can you bring it to my room? Yes, yes. And he went off into the darkness, and he has not come back. But then there are many hungry people in this town. I roll another cigarette and light it with my exotic matches and listen to the last prayer of the day coming from the mosque. Najibullah's uncle is driving us around Kabul in his taxi cab. We go by the lamppost where the Taliban hung the body of the president. We drive by the soccer stadium where the Taliban conducted public executions. Then we go to the zoo, which has been bombarded by mortar shells. There are a lot of empty cages with big holes in the walls, but there are still some animals alive. Some monkeys, some hawks and eagles and vultures, and a lion that looks senile and is missing an eye due to a hand grenade thrown by a man seeking revenge after his brother went into the cage and the lion ate him. Just outside the gates of the zoo, there's an entire neighborhood that's been demolished by bombardments, acres and acres of adobe buildings and ruins. What happened here? I asked Najibullah. It was the Hazara people who were living here, he says, and Massoud's army shelled them from that hill. Why? I ask. Because they are Hazara people, and Massoud's people are Tajik, he says, as if I should know this already, as if it was a natural phenomenon, like the sun coming up in the morning. What a f***ing mess, I say. I'm sorry. How long would it take in America to rebuild this place? Najibullah asks. Oh, hell, in America it might take 3 years. And how long will it take here? I don't know, I say. Maybe 50 years, maybe longer if everybody keeps hating each other for being from a different tribe. But I'll be an old man by then, he says. Yes, I say, you will be. My advice is you find a way to get out of here. Where will I go? He asks. Anywhere, I say. The world's a big place, and there are a lot of things to see, a lot of opportunities. But I think this is not possible for me, he says. I don't know what to tell him. If his family had any money, they would have left years ago, along with the rest of the middle class. Najibullah just looks at the ground and kicks a brick and says,
Scott Carrier reading from his book, Prisoner of Zion, When Hearing Voices. We'll be back with more in a minute.
From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
So I ask you, what would happen if we left the terrorists alone? What if we pulled our troops from their holy land and let them live like in the days of Muhammad? Why can't we be brave enough to let them test Sharia against the love of liberty? Would the harm be greater than what comes from violence, from responding out of fear? I think it would be far less. It's not that we do nothing, but that we do nothing out of fear. If we're not afraid of terrorists, then they lose.
Welcome back. This is Hearing Voices with Scott Carrier, reading from his new book, Prisoner of Zion. He's been telling us about a young man, Najibullah, who became his translator and guide and friend in Afghanistan. When we left off, Najibullah was in despair, realizing there wasn't going to be much of a future for him in Afghanistan. Scott takes it from there.
When I first met Najibullah Niazi in Afghanistan in 2001, at the beginning of the longest war in American history, he was only 17 years old. Now he's 27 and about to graduate from the state university where I work as a professor, Utah Valley University, UVU, in Orem, Utah. We're both wearing caps and gowns and flat-top hats with tassels. He's sitting on the floor of the basketball arena with the graduating class, and I'm up in the stands with the faculty and families. This is where we ended up. UVU and the Mormons took both of us in from the cold, but now Najib is getting out, and I may be stuck here. Before I left Afghanistan, I asked Najib for his address. Address? He asked. Where you get your mail? I said. Mail? He asked. From the post office, I replied. Post office? He'd never heard of such a thing. Afghanistan had trucks and roads, but had never had a government capable of delivering the mail. So we stayed in touch by phone. Najib found a job at the United Nations office in Mazar, and he'd call from work. Two or three times a year, my phone would ring at 3 or 4 a.m., and I'd hold it to my ear and fall into a cloud of static, cracklings of cosmic rays. And there would be Najib's thin, high voice whispering so his boss wouldn't hear. How is your family? Was always the first thing he'd say. My family's a mess, I'd say, but everyone's healthy, so that's good. Eventually, we'd get around to talking about his safety. People were after him, he said, because of some things I'd written about my trip to Afghanistan. His life was in danger, and he needed to get out of the country. I believed him. He was in a genuinely dangerous place, a war zone, and he put himself at risk by working for foreigners who many Afghans saw as infidels and invaders. I tried to think of a way to get him out. Finally, in 2006, I suggested he write a letter to Utah Valley University. Maybe they'd take him as a student. Maybe they wouldn't care that he dropped out of school when he was 12. What do I say in the letter? He asked. Write about your life, I said. Talk about the jobs you had when you quit school to make money for your family. Najib had learned English from watching American movies, Rush Hour and Rambo, and he didn't have much experience writing the language. But writing is mainly about the movement of the mind, and Najib's mind moved like a Ferrari. 3 weeks later, I got the first draft by email. It was barely readable, full of misspellings, grammatical errors, problems with punctuation, and so on. Still, once you figured out what he was saying, it was an amazing story. He began with the Russians pulling out of Afghanistan in 1989, when he was 5 years old. There was peace for a few years, but there were no jobs or money, just a lot of weapons left over from the war. The only thing people could do when they got hungry was go kill somebody and take whatever they had. This is how the Afghan Civil War started. Pashtuns, Uzbeks, Tajiks, and Hazaras, the various ethnic groups, all fought against each other. During this time, Najib was in grade school on the outskirts of Mazar-i Sharif. He was a bad student. He often fell asleep in class. His family had no money. His father had been a geology professor, but once the Russians left, there was no work. So Najib, when he was 12 years old, asked his father if he could quit school and go to work. At first his father said no, but finally he agreed. He'd keep Najib's two older brothers in school because this would be better for the family in the long run, but in order to get by in the present, he was willing to sacrifice Najib's future. At first Najib bought gasoline in Mazar, filled 1-liter bottles and carried them 10 miles out of the city. He could resell them for a few cents profit per liter. Then he built a box he could carry with a rope slung over his neck and filled it with gum and cigarettes. He made as much as $1 a day hawking his wares on the street. At that time, 1996, the Taliban had taken control of all of Afghanistan, except for the area around Mazar-i Sharif, where General Dostum and his Uzbek militia were in charge. Najib was afraid of Dostum's men, as they sometimes abducted young boys and forced them to dance and then rape them. He went to work every day afraid he wouldn't come home. Najib believed the Taliban had higher morals than Dostum's men, and so he wanted them to come to Mazar and take over. In 1997, they tried to. Najib was selling gum and cigarettes when he saw the first tank come racing into the city at full speed, flying a dirty white cotton flag and carrying men with long beards. Everybody started screaming, "It's the Taliban!" and ran away. The battle went on for 3 days, and in the end, Dostum's militia killed every single Talib, 5,000 in all, and left their bodies in the streets. Najib saw the bodies still lying in the street, being eaten by wild dogs. The smell of death was everywhere. A year later, the Taliban mounted a second assault, and this time they took the city. This time there were 8 or 9,000 bodies for the wild dogs to eat. The Taliban imposed Sharia law. Najib would walk around the city, passing bodies of men hanging from lampposts, their mouths stuffed with money. He watched public executions of women who'd shamed their families. At night, in his friend's basement, he watched smuggled videos from America and dreamed of someday being able to go there. It was a mind-blowing essay, written in a form where even the words seemed to have been blown apart. I decided to pass it on to the university without changing a thing. They wrote back in less than an hour, saying, "We want him. Tell him he's accepted." I understood why they wanted Najib, all right, but why had they wanted me? They told me I'd have complete academic freedom. No one would tell me what to teach or how to teach. And it wasn't so bad that almost all the students were Mormons, they said. I'd learned to become a better teacher because of it, they said. I didn't want to take the job. I thought it would mean admitting I'd failed as an independent writer and radio producer, but I was heavily in debt. I'd always spent more money on stories than I'd made. My friends and family were all telling me that if I didn't take the job, I'd be very irresponsible. I remember my first day of work, driving 50 miles south on the freeway during rush hour, thinking my life was over, and from now on I was going to die very slowly. I hated the job, and the result was that I was a lousy teacher. When I spoke in class, it felt like I was trapped in a large block of jello. I could speak, but it was hard to breathe. I could speak and my students could hear me, but my words had different meanings for them. They just sat there and looked at me, wondering what I did to get put inside a block of jello. On the first day of my first journalism class, I tried to tell the students the rules of journalism. The first rule, I said, is to tell the truth, or at least try to tell the truth. I'm 50 years old and I still don't know what the truth is or how to tell it, so I try and accept the consequences. I saw their faces tighten and their eyes squint like, "Who is this guy?" They already knew the truth and how to tell it because this was part of their religion. The truth was a list called the Articles of Faith, and they all had it memorized. For them, the truth was a matter of faith. For me, the truth was a matter of reason and logic. Same word, different meaning. Another rule of journalism, I said, is that the journalist works for the public, not the publisher. Normally, when you have a job, you owe your loyalty to the person who signs your paychecks, but a journalist owes his loyalty to his audience. This means that good journalists often get fired and end up unemployable because they won't take orders from their bosses and have to make it on their own, as freelancers or independents, with no regular paychecks or health insurance, living alone in low-rent apartments where they die from drinking and smoking too much. I pretty much lost that class in less than a half an hour. I didn't like my students, and they, in return, did not like me. Najib, however, got along with the young Mormons quite well. He made friends easily, especially friends who were girls. He'd bat his long eyelashes a couple of times and smile, and women of all ages would go weak in the knees. It was ridiculous. In Afghanistan, the only women he knew were his mother and his sisters, but in America, he was a rock star, changing his look from day to day, sometimes a goatee, sometimes a ponytail. Compared to the Taliban, the Mormons were a cakewalk. The only problem with them was that they were always trying to convert him, which for Najib was like somebody trying to smother him. He tried to tell them conversion was not possible for a Pashtun. A Pashtun who becomes a Christian is no longer a Pashtun. He's banished or killed. But the good Mormons just didn't get it. So he fell in with a small gang of bad Mormons on campus who never tried to convert him. These so-called bad Mormons had lost their faith and had fallen away from the church, and like most people their age, they were into sex and drugs and rock and roll. They liked to party, and so did Najib, only he didn't indulge in the vices, being a Muslim. This made him a good designated driver. Najib was studying business, and that was not my domain. I did, however, talk him into taking a course on Dada. I promised to help him write the paper he'd have to turn in for the final exam. When the time came, I told him, let's go for a drive up in the mountains. My plan was to teach him how to write like he talks. We drove up Provo Canyon, following the Provo River, past the turnoff to the Sundance Ski Resort, up to the Heber Valley, a place they call Little Switzerland. Take out a pen and paper, I said, and tell me who were the Dadaists. Najib put his notebook in his lap and sucked on his pen and said, the Dadaists were artists in Europe who thought art had too many rules and was boring, so they moved to Zurich in Switzerland, where there were no rules about art. Excellent, I said. Write that down, just what you said. It took him about 5 minutes, and when he read it back, he'd completely messed it up by trying to make it sound proper, and it made no sense at all. Exactly what my other students would do. Look down at that river, I said. Do you see any places where you could jump from rock to rock and make it across to the other side? No, he said. There's too much water. Well, imagine there is a place like that. I want you to think about writing as like jumping from rock to rock. Can you swim? Not very well, he said. Good. If you fall, you'll drown. In order to jump to a rock, you must answer my question honestly in your own voice, not the voice of someone else. If you try to answer in someone else's voice, you'll fall into the river and drown. Do you understand? Yes, he said. You jumped from the first rock by telling me who the Dadaists were. Now jump again and tell me, what did the Dadaists do? They sat in coffee shops and talked about new ways to make art. Whatever was pleasing to them, they called it art. Okay, I said. So what was pleasing to them? The one called Duchamp took a toilet, turned it upside down to make people see it for its shape, not for what it does. And what do you think about that? But what I think doesn't matter, he said. So now you're in the middle of the stream, and you're just going to stay there, I asked. Well, I have to call your father and tell him you were last seen in the middle of a river contemplating Dada? In order to keep going, you have to say what you think. Now, jump. Back home, if we wrote what we thought, we'd get beaten up by the teacher, he said. Do you think anyone here is going to beat you up? I asked. No. Then go for it. What did you think about the upside-down toilet? I didn't see it as a toilet. I saw it as a beautiful shape. Duchamp was trying to show there's more than one way to see the same thing. And for me, that blew my mind. Very good, I said. Write that down, everything you just said. It took a while to get everything down the way he said it. You're still out in the river, I said, and this next jump is the hardest one of all. You've told me who the Dadaists were, what they did, and what you think about it. Now tell me if learning this stuff made any difference in your life, or changed the way you see yourself and the world around you. He thought. The Dadaists like to hang out and take drugs and go crazy, he said, and then they would sleep with each other. This is what some of my friends do here, even though it's against the rules of their society. They used to believe in those rules, but now they don't. They want there to be no rules. And how does that make you feel? I asked. How does that make me feel? He asked. Yes. Do you have any feelings? Do you know what they are? I asked this as a joke, but when I said it, I thought about Najib walking through a street filled with dead bodies and wondered if I was being too harsh. It's fun and scary at the same time, he said. Yes, good, I said. And what's the word for that kind of feeling, fun and scary at the same time? He thought about it for a while, and then he said, I don't know. This is the last rock, I said. You make this one, you're across the river to the other side. So think about it. What's the word to describe those feelings? He thought some more and couldn't come up with it, so I told him. Freedom, I said. Fun and scary at the same time is called freedom. And that's what America is all about. I gave him the ending, just as many others have done for me in the past.
You You're listening to Scott Carrier's Prisoner of Zion on Hearing Voices.
Later, I talked him into reading The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. At first, the dialect threw him, but once he figured out what was going on, his first reaction was, "Why am I being forced to read the story of an uneducated boy who can't even speak good English?" His interest picked up when Huck fakes his own death and runs away to hide out on Jackson Island and has to survive by his wits. Najib Saeed had a similar experience when he went to work selling gum and cigarettes in a war zone. Then, when Huck dresses up like a girl and sneaks back into town to hear what's being said about his death, Najib recognized a kindred spirit. They were both professional liars. And when Huck and Jim set out on the river to get to freedom, this was like Najib coming to America, suddenly in a wild country, free from rules of his society, having to make his own decisions about right and wrong, good and bad. He was struck by the story of the feud between the Grangerfords and the Shepherdsons. Huck asks Buck Grangerford, only 14 years old, "Why do you want to kill a Shepherdson?" "It's called a feud," Buck answers, and Huck doesn't even know what that means. When Buck explains, Huck asks, "Why is there a feud?" Buck has no idea. The feud with the Shepherdsons had been going on for 100 years, and there was no need to know the cause. "In my own family," said Najib, "we have feuds that have been going on for hundreds of years. Men kill each other without having any personal reasons, just to carry on traditions. I'm learning that some of my beliefs were only tribal practices and not the rules of God. For instance," he said, "I would no longer tie my sister to a tree and shoot her with a Kalashnikov if she slept with a man who was not her husband." I was relieved to hear it. Once Najib told me, when he was working for the United Nations in Mazar-e-Sharif, they let him go on vacation. They sent him to the city of Lahore in Pakistan. This was a big, relatively modern city, and Najib was hoping he might get lucky and meet a girl. But he ended up walking around for days by himself, getting depressed by the filthy conditions and the meaninglessness of people's lives. One day when he was walking out of his hotel, he saw a midget sitting by the front desk. "Sir," the man said, "do you need anything? Perhaps you're going out to get mangoes. Do you like mangoes? Let me know if you need anything." Najib told the man that he didn't need anything, it's just that his room was very hot, so he was going out. "This girl likes you," said the midget, pointing to the girl behind the desk. She was about 19, with a round face and big eyes. "Thank you," said Najib. "She's very nice." "No," the man said. "She wants to f*** you. She needs 200 rupees, but she wants to sleep with you." Najib tried to give him the money right away, but the midget wouldn't take it. "She'll come to your room at 10 o'clock tonight," he said, "and then you can give her the money." It was a long day. Najib took a shower, went for a walk, ate a mango, took another shower, ate another mango. He worried about his father finding out, his tribe finding out, but the idea of losing his virginity was worth it. Finally, the girl knocked at the door. But then, as he was walking to the door, he realized he'd lost his desire. "It's as if you're so hungry," he said, "but then you come to a table full of food and you lose your appetite." The girl was twice the size he thought she'd be. He hadn't really seen her behind the desk. He wanted to change his mind. She asked if she could come in, and he was stuck. He couldn't say yes or no. So he said he was talking on the phone with his dad. "I'll come back," she said. Najib checked out of the hotel. He walked around town for 12 hours, listening to the dogs and smelling the shit in the streets, feeling homeless and scared. And he waited until his bus arrived, and it was time to leave. This is the fourth graduation ceremony I've sat through, and it may be my last. so I should enjoy it. Our president is handing out diplomas, one by one, as the name of each student is called. The tape of the song of the graduation march is playing over and over and over again. Babies are crying, people are yelling and whistling. Najib is finally up at the front of the line to pick up his diploma. He has a friend on the sidelines with a telephoto lens shooting pictures he can send to his family back home. I try to whistle. He's made it. He's out of here. In 2 months, he's getting married to a beautiful Afghan-American girl in California, and he has a lot of job offers. He wants to run for president of Afghanistan someday, and he just might pull it off. I, however, may be stuck here. I have 4 months off before I come back, if I come back, and in the meantime, the paychecks keep coming in. If I don't come back, the paychecks stop coming, and I'll have to survive by my wits like Najib on the streets of Mazar. The master stood with his student on the edge of a cliff. Jump, the master said. But I'll fall, said the student. Jump, the master said. So the student jumped, and he flew.
Scott Carrier, reading from his new book, Prisoner of Zion. It's an e-book, and you can easily download it to your e-book reader. See Scott's website, prisonerofzion.com, for details. The book is also about growing up among Mormons in Salt Lake City, a place which, in Scott's vision, is every bit as strange as Afghanistan, or Mars, for that matter.
Most cities are built on flat ground, where buildings and trees block the view of the horizon. But Salt Lake City sits in a valley between two separate mountain ranges and has something of the shape of a bowl. Inside this bowl, no matter where you are, you can see every other place in the bowl, distances of 20 miles, but nothing beyond it, unless you get up on the rim, on top of the mountains. From there, you can see the curve of the earth. This is what I'm used to, living in a bowl, a high desert basin. When I leave town and spend time in flat places, I start getting claustrophobic because everything is close up and nothing is far away. And if I stay too long, I have panic attacks. I tell this to my friends who live in flat places, and they say it is I who live in a claustrophobic place among the Mormons. How can you live there, they say, meaning, how can you live surrounded by religious fanatics? I was 8 years old, walking to school with my two friends. They told me they'd been baptized in the temple, and now they were going to a different heaven than I was, unless I converted. They said there are 3 levels of heaven, and they were going to the highest one, the celestial kingdom, but the best I could hope for was the 2nd level, the terrestrial kingdom, which isn't a bad place, just not the best place. There is, they said, no hell, except for a few really bad people, sons of perdition, who are cast into outer darkness. The best thing about the highest heaven, where they were going, was that through the law of eternal progression, they would someday become gods, like our God now, with their own planet, only somewhere else in the universe. They said they were telling me all this because they didn't want me to miss out. They wanted me to start reading the Book of Mormon and praying about whether it was true. We each had peach fuzz on our faces, pants with patches ironed onto the knees, carrying new math textbooks, and yet they were on their way to godhood, and I was just walking to 2nd grade. Sunday morning, 1962, a family restaurant. A husband, wife, and 2 young sons are eating lunch after attending church. The mother's dressed like Jackie Kennedy, white pillbox hat, long white gloves. The father wears a black suit like Joe Friday on Dragnet. The boys have black suits like their fathers, and crew cuts, freckles, and glasses that are taped together and hang sideways on their noses. The boys are uncomfortable in their Sunday clothes. The father is uncomfortable with his family. The mother asks her sons, "Well, what did you learn from the sermon this morning?" The minister was saying God listens to our prayers, says the younger son, age 5. So I was praying, asking God to move the light from the ceiling as a sign. Nothing happened. I don't believe in God, says the older son, age 6. The mother's shocked. Don't say that. There most certainly is a God. It's a lie, the boy says. There is no God. He's angry. The father's adding up the check, making sure the numbers are correct. The younger son looks out the window to the gas station across the street where a man is filling his tank. The man bursts into flames. The younger son looks at his dad, who says, they made a mistake, overcharged us by $2.38. The boy looks back to the man in flames, and he's rolling over and over on the asphalt, trying to put himself out.
Again, Scott's website for the book is prisonerofzion.com. I'm Larry Massett for hearingvoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.